B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, May 4th, 2018. Try not to hurt yourself celebrating Cinco de Mayo this weekend. Well, the Rudy Donnie bromance is turning into quite a debacle in its first week in action. And many of us are scratching our heads trying to figure out what the strategy was that Donnie and Rudy, that would be Trump and Giuliani, decided on without consulting the other lawyers on the Trump team or anybody else, it appears, even Crown Prince Jared Kushner. And when Giuliani went on to the Sean Hannity show on Fox to unpack the new version of the Stormy Daniels scenario, he certainly made things worse for Trump. And of course, it doesn't stop there, because Trump is so compulsive. He cannot help himself. And so today, in a series of comments and different little snippets, as Trump left the White House, then talked to reporters again at Andrews Air Force Base as he flew to Dallas for a speech to an NRA convention, and he undercut Rudy Giuliani. Now, of course, he says he's a great guy, but he said that Rudy's still getting up to speed on all of the details here, and that he will eventually get the facts right. Now, get this, Trump said, virtually everything said has been said incorrectly, and it's been said wrong, or it's been covered wrong by the press. But he didn't explain what's wrong. He didn't substitute his version of the truth for what he says is so erroneous about all this out there. And he leaves people just further confused, and whatever reputation he has is further diminished. Trump added, it's actually very simple, but there's been a lot of misinformation. Well, if it's so simple, tell us what the hell you mean. And, of course, Trump continues to deny that he ever had an affair with Stormy Daniels, even though all of this information that's come out this week does nothing but affirm that. And he kind of tangled or wrestled with reporters. They tried to ask him questions about Giuliani, about when he knew about the Michael Cohen effort to hush up Stormy Daniels. And all he did was push out this disinformation about what he says is misinformation. And along the way, he once again misstated facts. At one point, he said that Jim Comey had been Obama's FBI director for 8 years. That's simply not true. No, let me back up. He said Mueller, the special counsel, had been Trump. let me get this straight. That Mueller had been Obama's FBI director for 8 years. And I always thought it was a mistake that Obama held over Bob Mueller for an extra 2 years, but the fact is that Mueller served 5 years under Obama, and Comey handled the last 3 years of the Obama term. He also misstated, as he contradicted previous reports attributed to him, those previous reports were that he wanted to reduce the number of American troops in South Korea. And when it was reported that this was part of the softening of the chilly relations with North Korea, he said, oh, no, it's not connected to that. Troops are not on the table, absolutely. And then he said falsely, you know, we have 32,000 troops there. The actual number is 23,500. But, you know, hey, come on. A guy who loves to exaggerate by millions and millions and millions. What's 12 or 13,000 troops, huh? And Peter Baker gets it right in the opening sequence of his analytical piece in Friday's New York Times. I'll quote it. As of last week, the American public had been told that Trump's doctor had certified he would be the healthiest individual ever elected, that the president was happy with his legal team would not hire a new lawyer, that he did not know about the $130,000 payment to a former pornographic film actress who claimed to have had an affair with him. As of this week, it turns out that the statement about his health was not actually from the doctor, but had been dictated by Trump himself. that the president has split with the leaders of his legal team and hired the same new lawyer he had denied recruiting, and that Trump himself had financed the $130,000 payment intended to buy the silence of the actress known as Stormy Daniels. And because Trump is untethered to the truth, whatever comes into his head, whatever he decides to say, he imagines that many people will believe it. But I actually think he is starting to damage himself. There are even a couple of Fox News anchors who are at least partly separating from their support of the president because they cannot decipher what position he's actually taken. So let me quote a little bit from a verbatim of Trump's comments. He's been asked, have you changed your mind about being willing to sit with Robert Mueller? Well, the problem with sitting is this. You have a group of investigators. They say I'm not a target, and I'm not a target. But you have a group of investigators that are all Democrats. In some cases, they went to the Hillary Clinton celebration that turned out to be a funeral. So you have all these investigators. They're Democrats. In all fairness, Bob Mueller worked for Obama for 8 years. Well, Mueller never changed his party registration. As I just pointed out, he worked for Obama for 5 years, not eight. But hey, these are trivial little details when you're a stable genius like the Trumpster. So I would say this, he went on, and he does go on. I would love to speak, I would love to. Nobody wants to speak more than me. In fact, against my lawyers, because most lawyers, they never speak on anything. I would love to speak because we've done nothing wrong. There was no collusion with the Russians. There was nothing. There was no obstruction. He rambled on a little more, and then he said, wait. I have to find that we're going to be treated fairly because everybody sees it now. This is a pure witch hunt. Right now, it's a pure witch hunt. Why don't we have Republicans looking also? Why aren't we having Republican people doing what all these Democrats are doing? It is a very unfair thing. If I thought it was fair, I would override my lawyer. Now, out of that word salad, or is that word soup, what conclusion can you draw? Mainly that he's full of shit. And he's not going to talk to Mueller, not voluntarily. He can't keep his story straight from 1 minute to the next. And it would be a disbarment offense for any attorney, I believe, to recommend that Trump sit down and talk under oath. So to try to sort this out, I have linked in the show file for today's podcast to a brief but excellent takedown or breakdown of some of the legal issues here. And this is an op-ed from today's Washington Post under the bylines of Norman Eisen and Noah Bookbinder. And Eisen is on the board and at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, and Bookbinder is the executive director of CREW. Now, I took exception to CREW in 2016 because David Brock, one of the most furtive figures in American politics who was working for the Clinton campaign, in 2016, Brock muscled out my longtime friend who was the founding executive director of CREW, whose name is Melanie Sloan. And so this group has been reconstituted, and I don't find any connections of David Brock to it today. At any rate, they write that Giuliani's performance left the president exposed to possible liability for campaign finance, ethics, and false statements violations, and for good measure, deepened Trump's obstruction of justice peril. Until a couple of days ago, they say the president and his aides had responded to questions about the hush money, saying that the president knew nothing of it. The watchdog group CREW filed a complaint with the Department of Justice and Office of Government Ethics on Thursday, asking officials to investigate whether Giuliani's disclosures show that Trump violated federal ethics laws or laws against making false statements. The Ethics in Government Act requires filers of public financial disclosure forms, including the president, to disclose any liabilities of more than $10,000. Giuliani repeatedly acknowledged that on Wednesday and Thursday that Trump owed Cohen at least $250,000, including the $130,000 hush payment to Daniels. But Trump's financial disclosure report last summer didn't list any debts to Cohen. A knowing failure to report such a debt is a federal crime. Failure to properly report the liability can result in penalties up to $50,000 as well as imprisonment. And additionally, lying on a financial disclosure report can be the basis for federal false statements charges. Later, they write, Cohen was in some legal jeopardy because if he had paid Daniels out of his own funds, that might mean he had knowingly made an in-kind campaign contribution well in excess of the $2,700 limit per election to a federal candidate. But that story had distanced Trump from that or other alleged violations. Giuliani swept all that away when he disclosed that the payment to Daniels was funneled through a law firm and the president repaid it over a period of several months. Trump apparently had paid Cohen a retainer of $35,000 a month starting sometime after the election and continuing until the president paid a total of about $460,000. Quoting further, Giuliani is advancing the defense that because campaign money wasn't used to pay Daniels, there's no problem. That is a red herring. The problem with the transaction was always the fact that it was money from outside the campaign being spent for a campaign-related purpose. By revealing the repayment scheme, Giuliani implicated Trump in Cohen's apparent misconduct. Even the best-case scenario that the president, in effect, made a six-figure contribution to his own campaign is a violation of law because it was undisclosed. So, they add, if that weren't bad enough, the third area of Trump's exposure that Giuliani deepened is obstruction of justice. Giuliani harmed his client by offering that the president fired Comey because Comey would not, among other things, say that Trump wasn't a target of the investigation. Far from exculpating Trump, this assertion could constitute evidence that the president was acting with the corrupt intent necessary to establish obstruction. So thanks to Giuliani's catastrophic performance, yet another fresh start for Trump's legal team has been squandered. The president and his attorneys are running on empty in terms of credibility. And here's a real hoot from the op-ed pages of the New York Times today. The byline is Adam Schiff, the Democratic California congressman who is the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee and the number one promoter of the Trump-Russia narrative. He's the one who's on Rachel Maddow. She should be paying him because he's on almost every night. And he serves up these dire warnings about Trump being controlled by Russia and the Russian influence and hacking and all this stuff. And his headline reads, Democrats, don't take the bait on impeachment. And he has a long preamble about the impeachment of a federal judge from New Orleans named Thomas Porteous Jr. And he uses this as a cautionary tale, saying that, this is a move that is rare. And you have to make sure that it doesn't appear partisan. And he asks, was the president's conduct so incompatible with the office he holds that Democratic and Republican members of Congress can make the case that they were obligated to remove him? Well, if they can't, he sees this as a serious problem. And he closes by saying this, given the evidence that is already public, I can well understand why the president fears impeachment and seeks to use the false claim that Democrats are more interested in impeachment than governing to rally his base. Democrats should not take the bait. Let Trump arouse his voters as he will, while Democrats continue to focus on the economy, family, and a return to basic decency. This is such bullshit. And as I've told you, Maxine Waters, who is also a member of Congress from the Los Angeles area, has been very honest about this. The Democratic leadership has it wrong. They believe by downplaying impeachment, they can sneak back into control of the House and then maybe talk about impeachment after the November election. But I don't believe that without campaigning on impeachment, that the Democrats will regain control of the House. And so it goes. And it's not going well. So Trump goes to the NRA, first time since the series of major shooting incidents, including the high school shooting in Parkland, Florida. And he basically had a few comments about gun rights and then rambled on about North Korea, about the witch hunt, about the unemployment numbers. The takeaway comment here is your Second Amendment rights are under siege, but they will never, ever be under siege as long as I'm your president. Isn't that cartoonish? I mean, I have to admit that as of today, Trump is the president. And he claims that right now, your Second Amendment rights are under siege, but they will never, ever be under siege as long as I'm your president. I mean, it's so incoherent. And it's insulting, even to gun lovers and Second Amendment absolutists. So I already mentioned that Trump announced yesterday he's ordered the Pentagon to prepare options for drawing down American troops in South Korea. The actual number is 23,500. He bases that on cost factors. But it's clear it's also part of the declining tensions between North and South Korea. And I do support eventually a reduction in troops. But it really has to take a back seat to the negotiations. And we have to wait and see if Trump can screw that up. Meanwhile, on the Bob Mueller special counsel investigation, there is a turn in favor of Paul Manafort. Manafort was the guy who was consulting the Ukrainian kleptocrat Yanukovych. The U.S. supported the coup that took him out. We pretend that's not the case. And Manafort has been indicted in two different jurisdictions, one in Washington, D.C., and one in the Eastern District of Virginia. And the Virginia judge, T.S. Ellis III, who was appointed way back in 87 by Ronnie Reagan, well, he appears to have little patience for Bob Mueller. And he appears to be sympathetic to arguments from Manafort's lawyer that the tax evasion, money laundering, failure to report income charges, that those don't have anything to do with the scope of the special counsel's investigation. Now, the scope memo has been released, but it's heavily redacted. And so we don't know all of the parameters that were set by Rod Rosenstein when he named Mueller as the special counsel. But I actually think that there's a strong argument here. I don't for a minute think that Manafort is clean. I mean, from what we know just about what has been released in the court filings, he did launder millions of dollars through banks in Cyprus. There are large amounts of cash on some paper books that were kept in Ukraine. And we know that he owes Oleg Deripaska, a Russian oligarch, millions of dollars. I think the judgment was for $8 million. So I don't believe that Manafort is an innocent man. But the judge gets it right. He said, you don't really care about Manafort's bank fraud, talking to lawyers for Mueller. You really care about getting information from Manafort and that he can give you that would reflect on Trump and lead to his prosecution or impeachment. In the vernacular, the government wants Manafort to sing. And the full quote said, and maybe it's not just singing a song, it's an entire composition, something like that. He went on to say that the special counsel has set out to turn the screws and get the information that you really want. And honestly, because the law that governs the appointment of Bob Mueller is not the same as the special prosecutor laws that saw the Iran-Contra prosecutions and the Clinton investigation that led to impeachment, those are under different rules. And so the judge did challenge Manafort's arguments to some extent, but it appears he is quite sympathetic. And the judge in the Washington case has heard some of these same arguments, but in the oral exchange, he didn't seem as sympathetic to Manafort's lawyers. So Judge Ellis has asked for an unredacted version of the scope memo, and we will see how he rules. Both of these trials are coming up, scheduled for one in June or July, and one starts in September. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Benny Alto in Oregon, Faith Peoples, who is a very generous supporter, Sandra Fish, and our good friend Annette McManus. So thank you for your support, those individuals. And every day I make a pitch, if you're not a subscriber, it's not hard. If you got $5 a month, you can kick in to support the Peter B. Collins podcast. I'll be very grateful. Visit my website, peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu tab, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. You land on the sign up page, and it's pretty easy to take up a new subscription using PayPal. And I offer the option, if you're allergic to PayPal, you can communicate with me at my post office box. It's box 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. That's box 150-660, San Rafael, and the zipper, 94915. Well, it's good news that unemployment is declining. Trump, of course, wants to take credit for this. But I would submit that this is the pain and suffering that Barack Obama endured trying to right the economy after the Bush team nearly wrecked it in 2008. And it's fascinating to see Trump take credit for this because, of course, during the campaign, he said that the unemployment rate is meaningless. We have to look at all those people who've given up looking for a job, the part of the workforce that is not in the labor market. But we never hear about that anymore. And meanwhile, the San Francisco Chronicle reports that employers have quietly changed the terms for new hires. And while they continue to force them to submit to what I consider to be unconstitutional drug testing, they have quietly removed marijuana from the drug test that they require prospective employees. Marijuana testing has been undertaken for about 30 years, but it excludes too many potential workers, especially in states where medical marijuana and adult use are now legal. Gareth Porter, who has been a regular contributor to this program and a man I deeply respect, a journalist and historian, his latest piece at Consortium News Today adds new depth to the lies that were told by Benjamin Netanyahu in a PowerPoint presentation earlier this week before the Israeli Knesset granted him expanded war powers. And Porter tells us that the information that Netanyahu cited, 55,000 paper files, 55,000 CDs that were snatched from a highly secret location in Tehran by the Mossad this past January? Well, Porter calls bullshit, but he's more polite than that. He said that the tale requires that we accept a proposition that is absurd on its face, that Iranian policymakers decided to store their most sensitive military secrets in a small tin-roofed hut with nothing to protect it from heat, which would damage those CDs, and no sign of any security, based on the satellite image shown in the slideshow. And a New York Times reporter observed that the door did not even appear to have a lock on it. Ah, but the perfidy goes even deeper, because what Gareth Porter tells us is that these documents were ginned up, they're phonies, and they were created by the Mossad and apparently placed in the tin-roofed hut in Tehran so that they could go get them and tell the tale of great spycraft. There's more to the analysis. You can find it with the link in the show file at peterbcollins.com. One of the other cases that I remain seriously skeptical about, we've got a little new information from the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. They've been on the scene in Salisbury, England, and they are now asserting that the amount of liquid nerve agent that was applied to the doorknob of the Skripal home was more than they had predicted, and that the volume of this, as much as 50 grams, they're saying, of the potent nerve agent, which at its maximum, this would amount to about a half cup of liquid, that they're arguing it's significantly larger than the amount that would be created in a laboratory for research purposes. And the implication here, it's an inference because they don't say, but they're trying to buttress their arguments that only Russia could have done this. And the Times dutifully reports Russia has denied stockpiling the nerve agent, but British officials say they have evidence it has done so. No proof is offered. And the lack of evidence, we haven't heard a damn thing about Sergei Skripal since his daughter was released from the hospital. She told her cousin that there was no long-term damage to either one of them. That is not consistent. Also, the length of time that it took for this alleged nerve agent to kick in undermines the claim that it was a Novichok. And so this whole thing requires some transparency. And that has not been available so far. And unfortunately, I do not expect that to change. Here in California, the Sacramento Bee is disclosing that there are two Democrats running in the 4th District of California against uber-conservative Tom McClintock. I know this guy. I testified before a state legislative committee when he was serving in Sacramento 10, 12 years ago. And he is a creepy, pro-business Republican conservative. I'd love to see him defeated. But once again, the Democrats in Washington, this time Steny Hoyer, number 2 House Democrat, are putting their fingers on the proverbial Democratic scales. And they're squeezing out democracy from the primary. They are favoring Jessica Morse in this race. And get this, she would appear on the list that was prepared by Patrick Martin of the World Socialist website, of the spies, spooks, and other government-type people who are running as Democrats this year. Jessica Morse used to work for the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is widely known as the front for a lot of covert activities like rigging elections in other countries. So Steny Hoyer has kicked in $7,000 to Jessica Morse and confirmed that the donations are tantamount to an endorsement. But the progressive in the race, Regina Bateson, a political science professor on leave from MIT, well, she's trying to be polite about this. They say they received reassurances from the DCCC, the Democratic Campaign Committee, that they didn't plan to endorse in the race. But this is part of the bigger picture that we've been talking about. And my friend Norman Solomon has a great commentary published at Consortium News today. And he starts with the history of new Democrats in the Bill Clinton era, and he links Obama and Clinton and their corporate policies, the corporatists that they appointed to top cabinet posts. And then he talks about the Democratic National Committee and the effort that he and other progressives have been making to eliminate the role of superdelegates, who, as you know, I blame most significantly for the choice of Hillary Clinton and the debacle of the 2016 presidential race. So he singles out a member of the top Democratic National Committee. She's a party official named Elaine Kamark, and she also is a fellow, or she's affiliated with the Brookings Institution. And she has worked on some Democratic and some Republican campaigns over the years. Despite that kind of split loyalty, she goes back to being a new Democrat under Bill Clinton. And she believes that the Democratic Party should increase the number of superdelegates and put up a screening process, a pre-primary endorsement process for the presidential campaigns to screen out those that the party leaders don't believe warrant exposure to the voters. This is totally undemocratic, and Elaine Kamark enhances her undemocratic posture in an op-ed that I've linked to from today's New York Times. And she slams the people who believe that this is undemocratic. She cites a person who is unhappy with much of the committee's interference. Democratic leaders have intervened, she says, in my count, in 14 primary races, suggesting that someone run for a different office or clear the field for a stronger candidate. Is this legitimate? My answer is an unqualified yes. That's what party leadership is all about. Hey, thanks a lot, Elaine. Today I'm releasing a new in-depth interview to my subscribers at peterbcollins.com with science journalist and author Suzanne Bowen. Her new book is called 20 Years of Life, Why the Poor Die Earlier and How to Challenge Inequity. And she helped discover, and she won a journalism award for figuring out that many communities have bad health outcomes because of the lack of access to parks, the lack of educational opportunities, and the general impact of poverty. And the book offers a lot of inspiring anecdotes about activists who have taken control of their issues and made great progress. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Suzanne Bowen.
This is about funding change, not charity. And this, ultimately, the book is a message in many ways to not only individuals about the power you can possess if you collectively organize to change your neighborhood, but also to philanthropy, that just starting another program that disappears mm-hmm. when the services are all given out or the funding stream dries up. But this creates lasting change by creating a political infrastructure and changes the culture.
I hope you'll listen to the full half-hour interview with Suzanne Bowen. It's the audio track from a recently recorded video interview that will be airing on Marin TV here in my community at the end of May. Couple of quickies here before I go. Facebook has decided that liberal bias has to be addressed, and they have tapped retired Arizona Senator John Kyle to lead the effort to scrub Facebook of all that dangerous liberal bias. Remember John Kyle? Well, he has hung out with a lot of prominent anti-Muslim conspiracy theorists like Dutch lawmaker Geert Wilders, writer David Horowitz here in the U.S. He once said on the Senate floor that Planned Parenthood spends 90% of its money on abortions when the figure is actually 3%. So here's a guy who has a limited association with facts and the truth. And Facebook is asking him to help them fight fake news. And finally today, a footnote to the ugly protests by white nationalists in Charlottesville, Virginia, last August. Two white supremacists have been found guilty in the violent beating of a black man in a parking garage after the main protest had broken up. A Georgia native, Alex Ramos, age 34, is facing 5 to 20 years behind bars, and his conviction followed the conviction of Jacob Goodwin, another man who beat the victim here, whose name is Harris. Let me find his first name. DeAndre Harris. And he's facing up to 10 years in prison. And none of this would have occurred if Greg Palast's cameraman had not captured the beating in the parking garage, and that was central evidence in the case. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it far and wide. You'll find it on YouTube, and if you visit YouTube, click on the subscribe button, please.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.